I'm Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Kennedy.
Welcome to the Deep Dive, and this is the Federal News Update for Friday, October 31st, 2025. It is Halloween 2025, and our mission today is pretty specific. We're going to give you a really granular, exhaustive report on basically every action, every activity of the U.S. federal government that's happened since the start of October 30th.
Yeah, and that might sound like just another news roundup, but the context here is absolutely critical.
Exactly. We are operating in a, well, an extraordinary situation.
Yeah.
Day 30 of a government shutdown.
That's the key piece. You know, the shutdown isn't just background noise anymore. It's fundamentally become the operating context for the entire federal apparatus. And what our sources are showing pretty clearly is that this shadow, this period of less legislative oversight, this general chaos, it's actually been used strategically.
By the executive branch.
Right. They pushed through an unusually aggressive set of actions. We're talking defense, immigration, economic strategy, all packed into this period.
It really feels like a collision. You've got these huge transformative policy shifts hitting all at once. Things like radical immediate changes in immigration enforcement.
Yeah.
Stuff that's going to affect hundreds of thousands of workers.
And then there's the overhaul of defense personnel policy, a really high-stakes economic decision from the Fed.
All while Congress is, well, largely sidelined by the shutdown. And crucially, this is all happening inside what we're calling the data fog.
The data fog. Yeah, that's a big part of it. The regular flow of government data, economic stats, that kind of thing. It's just stopped.
So our deep dive today is really about cutting through that fog. We need to analyze the impact, probably the lasting impact of these policies.
We have to understand how these actions push through with, you know, maximum executive authority are reshaping the federal landscape, especially when the usual checks and balances and honestly, the basic empirical data you need for sound governance were just diminished completely.
Okay, so let's start right there. Let's start with the crisis itself, the political impasse on day 30, and the direct human costs we're seeing. Right. Let's unpack the politics of this first. We are literally one day away from a, well, a humanitarian cliff.
Yeah, day 30 of the shutdown. And you look at Congress, the House last voted way back on September 19th. They've been in recess ever since.
And the Senate. They held a few committee meetings, sure, but then adjourned for the weekend, despite everything escalating.
And this impasse, it's not just abstract budget fights anymore. It's creating immediate real-world hardship, like actual hunger.
The big deadline is tomorrow, Saturday, November 1st. That's when SNAP benefits food stamps for about 42 million Americans are set to just expire.
And it's not just SNAP, WIC funding, too. That's for pregnant women, new moms, young kids. It lapses at the same time.
This isn't just a minor hiccup. It's a huge immediate flashpoint. Hits the most vulnerable people first.
And you can see how serious it is by the reaction outside D.C. The states are unified on this.
Yeah, we saw that formal unified response from 21 governors, bipartisan, led by Michigan's Gretchen Whitmer.
They sent a formal letter straight to the White House, basically saying, you need to prevent a nationwide hunger crisis.
It's state leaders telling the federal government, look, this failure is an unacceptable humanitarian threat. You need to intervene now.
And the courts are getting involved, too. On October 30th, there was a hearing in Boston, U.S. District Judge Indira Talwani.
Right. Hearing arguments on whether to force the USDA to release contingency funds, about $6 billion, I think.
Exactly. The legal fight is over whether the USDA can use that reserve money for SNAP during a shutdown like this.
And the judge, Talwani, seemed pretty skeptical of the government's argument. There were some really pointed comments reported.
Yeah, she was quoted saying something like, if you don't have money, you tighten your belt. You are not going to make everyone drop dead because it's a political game someplace.
Wow. That's more than just legal deliberation. That sounds like real judicial impatience,
mm-hmm.
Almost a moral condemnation of just letting these benefits stop.
And, you know, that skepticism seems warranted. The USDA's legal position looks, well, contradictory.
How so?
They apparently had a shutdown plan published earlier, which they later deleted, by the way, that specifically said they were mandated to use that reserve fund if appropriations lapsed.
So they said one thing before, and now they're arguing the opposite.
Pretty much. Now their lawyers are saying, oh, that $6 billion contingency fund, that's only for unforeseen stuff like hurricanes, not for a, you know, totally foreseeable political meltdown. It seems like a legal double standard.
So while the federal government is caught up in legal arguments,
local governments are actually stepping in. They see it as an immediate crisis.
Like in D.C., Mayor Muriel Bowser announced on the 30th, the city's using its own funds, $29 million, to cover SNEP and WIC for November.
For their 141,000 residents who rely on it.
That's basically city leadership saying the federal government isn't doing its most basic job right now.
And it's not just the citizens who rely on SNEP. We really have to look at the crisis unfolding inside the federal workforce itself. The uncertainty, the financial stress, and maybe even intentional destabilization. It's having a huge effect on how the government functions.
That morale issue is definitely critical. And we have numbers on it, right? That Federal News Network survey.
Yeah, conducted earlier this month, nearly 70% of federal employees said this shutdown feels different, more uncertain than past ones.
And the main reason? According to the sources, it's because the administration has openly threatened mass layoffs, these RIFs, reductions in force.
And they've questioned the legal guarantee of back pay. It makes employees feel like targets, not just bystanders caught in the middle.
People describe the situation using words like unpredictable, stressful, and unstable.
Exactly. It feels like a real shift. In past shutdowns, maybe employees felt like collateral damage. This time they feel like, you know, political pawns, like they're being intentionally destabilized.
So the administration might be using this funding crisis not just to stop operations temporarily, but to actually try and permanently reshape the workforce.
That seems to be the intent. It was demonstrated pretty concretely when they actually initiated those RIF.
Right, those layoff notices.
About 4,200 federal workers across different agencies got formal notices. Now, a federal judge did put a temporary halt on that action.
But the message was sent.
Exactly. The signal is, this administration plans to use the financial crisis to permanently downsize the federal government. It raises the possibility of, you know, a defunded government becoming the new baseline.
And while that threat is hanging over the civilian workforce, the financial chaos is hitting everywhere, especially military pay.
Oh, yeah. Troops were supposed to get paid Friday, October 31st. But as of Thursday, reports were that many hadn't even seen the pay pending in their accounts. Huge anxiety.
And the White House had to do some serious financial juggling to cover that, right?
Yeah.
Billions of dollars.
Significant and probably legally complicated scrambling. They pulled money from all over. $8 billion from DoD R&D accounts, $1.4 billion from procurement funds, another $2.5 billion from that, ironically named One Big Beautiful Axe money meant for military housing.
And wasn't there a private donation involved too?
Yes, they even accepted a $130 million donation from billionaire Timothy Mellon to help cover military salaries, which, you know, raises its own questions about relying on private money for core defense functions.
The anxiety level must have been sky high. Navy Federal Credit Union even had a banner on its website.
That's right. Notifying members they hadn't received the military pay funds yet and were monitoring the situation. That shows a really tangible level of financial instability for service members, people doing essential work.
And it's not just the furloughed staff or the military. Even people still working are affected.
Like the Passport Services staff. They're considered accepted, so they have to work during the shutdown. But they're doing it without pay.
Why? Don't passport fees cover their costs?
Usually, yes. But during a funding lapse, that fee revenue often doesn't flow directly back to pay them immediately. So they're stuck working, unpaid, asking, hey, what happened to our funds? It just highlights how widespread and complex this financial mess is across the whole federal government.
Okay, so beyond these individual and agency crises, let's connect this operational chaos to that bigger systemic problem, the economic data fog.
Mm.
This is where the politics really hits monetary policy, and that creates huge risk globally.
Yeah, the data vacuum is probably the biggest systemic consequence of the shutdown. It means the suspension of official economic data collection and reporting. Critical stuff.
Like what kind of data are we missing?
The basics. The consumer price index, CPI, so inflation measures. Official GDP figures. The monthly employment reports. Consumer spending indicators, all the key metrics that tell us the health of the U.S. economy in real time, the government is effectively flying blind.
And what does that mean for the Federal Reserve, for global financial markets?
Well, it forces the Fed's main policy body, the FOMC, the Federal Open Market Committee, to make decisions without its usual toolkit. They're basically flying blind.
Relying on what instead? Private data. Anecdotes.
Exactly. Incomplete, often conflicting private sector info, anecdotal reports, not the official, reliable government data that usually underpins their decisions. This is a really unprecedented level of uncertainty for the world's most important central bank.
And we know, as we'll get into detail shortly, the FOMC did make a key interest rate decision on October 30th.
Right.
So making a move that critical affecting global bond yields, mortgages, everything without the necessary data. that dramatically increases the risk of a major policy mistake, right? Like
Bro.
either fueling inflation or causing a recession by accident.
Absolutely. The data fog injects massive uncertainty into global markets. It fuels volatility. It could erode confidence in U.S. assets just when global stability is really needed.
And it seems like this instability, this vacuum, almost serves as cover. It diverts attention.
It absolutely can. Public attention, legislative attention. It's focused on the shutdown drama. And that potentially allows the executive branch to push through these massive controversial policy changes, things that would normally take months of debate and scrutiny.
So let's dive into those now, these big transformative policy shifts, starting with Homeland Security and education.
The sheer number of major regulatory changes, often pretty ideologically driven, that were pushed through on just one day. It's really astounding, especially when the government is supposedly consumed by this budget failure.
Let's start with the Department of Homeland Security. They issued an immediate rule change affecting employment authorization documents, EADs.
Yeah, this was fast. An IFR, an interim final rule. DHS published it on October 30th, and it was effective immediately. No public comment period allowed.
And what does this rule do?
It terminates a long-standing, really critical policy. The automatic extension of EADs for most people applying for a renewal.
Can you remind us why that automatic extension policy existed in the first place? That context seems important.
It was basically an administrative necessity, a bridge. USCIS processing times for renewals are notoriously long, and they've been getting worse for years. Right now, reports say anywhere from 7 to 12 months for many applications.
So without the automatic extension?
People who are legally present in the U.S. waiting for their renewal would lose their jobs, lose their ability to support their families, just because the agency itself is backlogged. The extension prevented that gap.
And now that bridge is gone. Just like that.
Yeah.
What reason did the administration give for such an abrupt, disruptive change?
They framed it entirely as a national security issue. The claim is that the automatic extension created a security vulnerability.
How so?
They argue it allowed non-citizens to keep working without undergoing concurrent, up-to-date vetting and screening checks while their renewal was pending. The USCIS director, Joseph Edlow, talked about a renewed emphasis on robust alien screening, claiming the old policy put aliens' convenience ahead of American safety.
But wait, the practical impact seems to directly contradict that.
Mm-hmm.
If people lose their jobs because of agency delays, that creates instability, right?
Right.
It feels like they're almost weaponizing their own inefficiency.
That's exactly the critique. That's the key insight here. By removing this administrative bridge, the predictable result is that hundreds of thousands of legally present people will be forced out of their jobs, not because their application was denied, but simply because they're stuck waiting months for USCIS to process it.
So it's not really about security vetting. It's about using the agency's own backlog as a tool.
It certainly looks that way. It functions as a de facto way to reduce the legal non-citizen workforce by leveraging processing delays. And the impact on U.S. employers will be severe and immediate. Disruptions across all kinds of sectors.
Which specific groups are hit hardest by this IFR?
Mm.
It's not just an abstract change, right?
No, the impact is very specific and disproportionate. It hits spouses of H-1B high-skilled workers really hard. That's category C-26. Many of them are from India, often highly educated professionals themselves. It also affects asylum seekers, category A-5, and people waiting for their green card applications, their adjustment of status, category C. These are folks deeply integrated into the U.S. economy. Tearing them out of the workforce overnight is devastating for them and their employers.
And what was the reaction from, say, U.S. business groups to this sudden regulatory shock?
Immediate and overwhelmingly negative condemnation across the board. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, major law firms, they called it a profound self-inflicted wound on the economy.
What are they advising businesses to do?
Urgent workforce audits. Revise your I-9 compliance protocols basically overnight to avoid huge fines. And everyone expects court challenges. Critics argue the rule violates the Administrative Procedure Act because it was imposed with zero public input.
Okay, so that DHS rule used the banner of national security. Now let's shift to the Department of Education. They used their rulemaking power to reshape the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, PSLF. And it looks like they introduced some explicit ideological criteria. This rule takes effect July 1st, 2026.
Yeah, this is a really clear example of using the mechanics of a federal benefit program to push a specific political agenda. The final rule, announced October 30th, significantly narrows the definition of a qualifying employer for PSLF.
And PSLF is the program designed to forgive student loans for people who work in public service for 10 years, right?
Correct. It's a major incentive for people to take lower paying jobs in government or at nonprofits.
So what's this new ideological test? How can the Secretary of Education now exclude an employer that might otherwise qualify, like a nonprofit?
The rule adds a clause allowing the secretary to exclude any organization determined to engage in activities with a substantial illegal purpose. And this is where the political targeting becomes really obvious.
What examples did they give?
The rule provides specific, highly politically charged examples of activities that could get an employer disqualified. Things like aiding and abetting illegal immigration, supporting terrorism, or performing prohibited medical procedures that attempt to transition children away from their biological sex.
Wow. So if the whole point of PSLF is rewarding public service, doesn't adding these criteria basically turn it into an ideological loyalty test? It seems to undermine the nonpartisan idea of the program.
That's exactly what critics are arguing. They see it as weaponizing a federal benefit program to punish nonprofits whose missions clash with the administration's conservative ideology.
It must create a huge amount of uncertainty for these organizations.
Absolutely. Think about a civil rights group or an LGBTQ plus advocacy organization. They might suddenly be deemed ineligible if the secretary decides their perfectly legal work falls under that vague, substantial illegal purpose category.
That kind of vague, arbitrary language seems designed to create a chilling effect.
For sure. Advocacy groups now have to worry if their mission puts their employees' access to loan forgiveness at risk. The fear is that organizations might self-censor, pull back from controversial but legal advocacy just to protect their employees' benefits. Benefits that might be the only reason those employees can afford to stay in public service jobs.
And this rule was finalized despite public comments.
Yes. Nearly 14,000 public comments were received, and the vast majority were reportedly highly critical. But the rule moved forward anyway.
Okay, moving from student loans to refugee policy, we also saw an administrative shift related to how refugee resettlement is handled, and it seems to reflect the administration's broader policy direction there, too.
Right. This involved transferring the responsibility for the initial domestic resettlement of refugees. It's moving from the State Department over to the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS.
The official reason given is efficiency, avoiding duplication, maybe returning to the structure from the Refugee Act of 1980. But why does moving it out of the State Department actually matter in practice?
Well, when the State Department handles initial resettlement, the program is naturally viewed through the lens of foreign policy, diplomacy, humanitarian commitments. It's about international relationships, projecting soft power.
And moving it to HHS.
Fundamentally shifts the perspective. It becomes much more of a purely domestic social service operation managed by an agency focused on domestic health and welfare programs.
We have to see this shift in the context of the administration's overall refugee policy, right? Which has been highly restrictive.
Exactly. The administration has already set a record low refugee admissions ceiling, just 7,500 for fiscal year 2026. And they've been explicit about prioritizing certain groups, like white South Africans, for example.
So consolidating the resettlement function under HHS could be seen as a way to tighten control.
Potentially. It could be aimed at centrally controlling a much narrower, more selective vision of the refugee program. It reinforces the idea that resettlement is now viewed primarily as a limited domestic issue, kind of detached from broader diplomatic considerations. And these domestic policy shifts, often wrapped in language about national security or taxpayer protection, were happening at the same time as really critical actions on defense policy and the use of military force, which brings us squarely into the national security arena from October 30th.
Right. The Department of Defense seemed like a major hub of activity, both internally and externally. Let's start with that really striking internal move, stripping job protections for civilian employees. The memo called Separation of Employees with Unacceptable Performance.
Yeah, that memo signed by Undersecretary Anthony Totter was dated back in September, but only became public on October 30th. And its effect was immediate. It suspended the requirement for managers to even attempt rehabilitation for employees deemed underperforming.
What does that mean in practice? No more performance improvement plans.
Essentially, yes. Managers are no longer required to offer things like a formal PIP or consider reassignment before moving straight to firing someone.
That sounds like a massive change, a huge hit to due process for these employees.
Legal experts are definitely sounding the alarm. They say it strips away significant due process protections, making it much quicker and potentially more arbitrary to terminate civilian employees. It functionally pushes DOD civilian jobs much closer to the at-will employment standard you see in the private sector.
Who said that? Was there a specific expert?
Sean Timmons, a managing partner at Tully Rinke, warned about this. He basically said the department is using legal jargon to hide an effort to make arbitrary firings easier.
And critics are linking this specific policy change to a larger pattern, right? A potential politicization of the civilian workforce within DOD.
Absolutely. Virginia Birder from the Project on Government Oversight, PIOGO, sees this memo as part of a bigger push by Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth to shrink and reshape the civilian workforce.
She called it political maneuvering.
Yes, arguing it's designed to enable the quick removal of people who don't align with their vision and their political ends, basically clearing the way for more ideologically aligned appointees or employees.
The memo mentions the 12 Douglas factors, which are supposed to ensure fairness in disciplinary actions. How does this new policy get around those?
Okay, so the 12 Douglas factors are the standard legal checklist used in federal employment cases to decide if a penalty, like firing, is appropriate and fair. They look at things like the employee's record, the seriousness of the issue, if the rules were clear, if the employee was warned, stuff like that.
So they're meant to provide consistency.
Exactly. But this new memo kind of navigates around them by adding language that makes the criteria for removal much more subjective. For example, it says even small lapses can accumulate to justify removal if they hinder DOD's efficiency.
That sounds incredibly broad. Hinder efficiency.
Right. That kind of language gives managers huge discretion to label almost any performance issue as grounds for immediate firing, potentially sidestepping the more balanced consideration the Douglas factors are supposed to ensure.
And the timeline itself seems weaponized, designed to rush the process.
That's probably the most aggressive part tactically. The memo imposes a really strict new timeline. Employees get only 7 days to respond to a proposed removal notice.
7 days? That's barely enough time to find a lawyer, let alone prepare a defense.
Exactly. And then the deciding official has only 30 days to issue a final decision. Analysts say this compressed timeline is deliberately designed to overcome the caution that DOD lawyers often have pushing for a fast decision.
So the goal seems to be speed, forcing a quick outcome, potentially before a full defense can even be mounted.
Pretty much. Ron Sanders, a former senior federal executive, put it bluntly. The memo gives managers the benefit of the doubt and encourages them to just take their chances before a third party, meaning risk an appeal later. It prioritizes speed and perceived alignment over established due process, and the shutdown chaos helps bury this massive shift.
Okay, shifting from internal DOD changes to external actions.
Mm-hmm.
We had that sudden, really surprising directive about nuclear testing, delivered by the president himself, via Truth Social while he was overseas.
Yeah, that was a major geopolitical moment. Came out of nowhere. President Trump directed the Department of War, his term, to immediately start nuclear weapons testing on an equal basis with Russia and China.
And the timing wasn't accidental, right? It followed meetings and missile tests by others.
Exactly. It came shortly after his meeting with Xi Jinping in South Korea, and it followed recent announcements of missile tests by both Russia and North Korea. The president's stated rationale was basically, they're testing, so we should too, even though the U.S. hasn't done full-scale nuclear tests in decades.
But let's talk feasibility versus optics here. First, that Department of War terminology.
Right. Retired Air Force Brigadier General John Ticker pointed out that nuclear testing historically falls under the Department of Energy, specifically the National Nuclear Security Administration, NNSA, not DOD. So using Department of War is either just a semantic choice by the president or shows a lack of precision about how this stuff actually works.
More importantly, though, is immediate testing even possible, technically?
Experts say absolutely not. The infrastructure needed for full-scale underground tests, probably at the Nevada National Security Site, is highly specialized. Estimates are it would take up to 3 years just to prepare the site, certify it, get the staff in place.
So the call for immediate testing is
technically impossible. It makes it clear this was primarily a political statement, a message aimed at adversaries, regardless of the practical realities on the ground.
And the reaction in Congress split right down party lines, didn't it? Reflecting that deep divide on national security strategy.
Oh, immediately. Republicans, like Senator Risch and Speaker Mike Johnson, praised it, called it a strong message to adversaries, pushing back against Putin, reasserting American strength. They focused purely on the deterrence signal.
But Democrats, especially those with defense backgrounds, saw huge risks.
Yeah, Senators Mark Kelly and Elizabeth Warren were very vocal. They warned that resuming U.S. testing would be a catastrophic gift to China. It could trigger a global testing spiral. Iran, India, Pakistan might all feel justified in restarting their own tests.
And Senator Warren also brought up the cost, right? Especially during a shutdown.
Yes, she specifically highlighted the immense unstated cost of preparing for tests when the government isn't even fully funded. She argued Republicans who preach fiscal responsibility should be outraged by the financial implications when they can't even fund basic programs like SNAP.
Okay, this theme of maximum executive authority definitely continued with those highly contentious military strikes, the lethal ones in the Caribbean and Pacific.
Right, this is an ongoing campaign. Lethal strikes against vessels suspected of drug smuggling. And the death toll is significant. Reports say at least 57 fatalities since early September. The latest strike on October 30th apparently killed 14 alleged narco terrorists in the Eastern Pacific.
And the big flashpoint on October 30th was that classified briefing for the House Armed Services Committee, the HASC. They were supposed to get the legal justification for these strikes.
And Democratic members came out of that briefing absolutely fuming. That was the word used. The ranking member, Gregory Meeks, called the session incredible and not in a good way. He cited a profound lack of substance and, critically, no credible legal rationale for using lethal force this way outside a declared war zone.
And didn't the lawyers who were supposed to provide that legal rationale cancel at the last minute?
They did. Administration lawyers who were reportedly going to explain the justification, apparently based on a really broad interpretation of presidential power derived from post-9/11 counterterrorism frameworks, just didn't show up.
Which left a huge legal vacuum right when Congress was trying to do its oversight job.
Exactly. Representative Seth Moulton described the situation vividly. He said the military officials in the room simply couldn't answer the legal questions because the lawyers weren't there. He apparently told the deputy commander of U.S. Southern Command directly that they were operating in constitutional peril due to the lack of transparency and clear legal authority from the executive branch.
And this isn't just raising concerns in Congress, right? There's legal condemnation from outside groups, too.
Oh, yes. Amnesty International has flat out called the strikes illegal extrajudicial killings. They argue the laws of war just don't apply in this context, in the Caribbean and Eastern Pacific, against these targets.
And geopolitically, there's speculation about the real motives.
There is. Friction is building. And there's widespread speculation, fueled partly by comments from former Ambassador James Story, that the counter-narcotics mission might be, at least in part, a pretext for applying military pressure on Venezuela. Given the massive U.S. military buildup in the region, including positioning the USS Gerald R. Ford carrier strike group nearby.
And finally, the whole oversight process seemed to break down along partisan lines, leading to some really strong accusations.
That's right. Senator Mark Warner, the top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, issued a really strong condemnation. He blasted the administration for reportedly excluding Democrats from key intelligence briefings on these strikes.
And for withholding the legal opinion.
Yes, withholding the crucial Office of Legal Counsel, OLC, opinion from the Justice Department that supposedly justifies the strikes. Warner called this partisan exclusion indefensible and dangerous. He said it was a direct slap in the face to Congress's war powers responsibilities, suggesting the administration is deliberately using the shutdown chaos to avoid full bipartisan scrutiny. So while all these aggressive defense and policy moves were happening, the administration was also using powerful economic tools and engaging in some high-stakes diplomacy, all still against that backdrop of the data fog.
Okay, let's start with the economy right here at home. The Federal Reserve, remember, operating without that reliable government data, made a decision on interest rates on October 30th.
They did. The FOMC lowered the federal funds rate target by 25 basis points. That brings the range down to 3.75% to 4.00%.
And that was the second cut in a row, wasn't it?
Yes, second cut in as many meetings, which definitely signals they have some real concerns about where the economy is heading.
What was driving that decision? It seems a bit counterintuitive, given that inflation is still running above the Fed's 2% target.
Well, the committee's statement indicated they acted because of clear signs, even if the data is incomplete of a weakening labor market. They noted that job gains have slowed and that downside risks to employment rose in recent months.
So they're trying to stimulate things, ward off recession risk.
Essentially, yes. Prioritizing the employment side of their mandate over the inflation side right now, it's that classic difficult policy trade-off they always face.
But the risk level here, because of the data fog, has got to be incredibly high.
It is. Making this call while flying blind just dramatically increases the chance of a major policy error. You know, cut too much, you risk letting inflation get worse. Cut too little, you might let a recession deepen.
Was the decision unanimous?
No, and that really highlights the uncertainty. There were two dissents on the FOMC. One official actually wanted a bigger cut, 50 basis points. Another official wanted no cut at all. That kind of split, for opposite reasons, shows just how precarious their balancing act is right now without the usual data tools.
Okay, shifting to enforcement on the economic side. The Small Business Administration, the SBA, took some really rapid, maybe unusually rapid, action against a company accused of acquisition fraud. This relates to a key program for disadvantaged businesses.
Yes. On October 30th, the SBA suspended a company called ATI Government Solutions, along with three of its executives, from all federal contracting. ATI is majority owned by the Susanville Indian Rancheria.
What triggered such fast action? Suspension is a pretty serious penalty.
It came just one day after a video surfaced. It was released by the O'Keefe Media Group, which is a conservative activist organization. The video appeared to show an ATI official admitting on camera to defrauding the 8A program.
Okay, remind us what the 8A program is and what was the specific violation alleged here.
Right. The 8A Business Development Program is a really important federal program. It's designed to help small businesses owned by people considered socially and economically disadvantaged, often minority-owned businesses or tribes, compete for federal contracts. The specific rule ATI allegedly broke involves subcontracting limits. The 8A firm is generally required to perform a significant portion of the work itself, often at least 50%, on service contracts. The video suggested ATI was routinely doing less than that, potentially acting more like a pass-through for larger, non-disadvantaged subcontractors.
That speed suspension within 24 hours of the video surfacing sounds highly unusual for government action. Does it raise due process concerns?
It absolutely does. Experts in federal acquisition law, like Sam Lay, pointed this out. They said the suspension happened in record time and likely without the SBA following its ordinary process. Usually, they'd issue a show cause letter first, giving the company a chance to respond to the allegations before imposing such a severe government-wide penalty.
And what might be the wider consequences of this rapid action for the 8A program itself?
Well, experts are warning it could have a chilling effect, especially coming at a time when the administration has also lowered the overall government goal for contracting with small disadvantaged businesses from 15% back down to 5%.
So firms might be scared off.
Yeah, the concern is that other 8A firms might become reluctant to participate, fearing they could be targeted by activist groups and then face unilateral suspension without getting a fair chance to defend themselves. It potentially undermines trust in the program.
And the administration wasn't just using domestic enforcement tools. They were also deploying powerful economic weapons internationally, right? For security goals.
That's where the Treasury Department comes in. Specifically, OFAC, the Office of Foreign Assets Control. They announced comprehensive sanctions against a group called the Bardwaj Human Smuggling Organization, or HSO.
Where are they based? What's the scope?
They're described as a sophisticated transnational criminal group based in Cancun, Mexico. The sanctions target the leader, three key associates, and 16 affiliated companies. These companies are spread across Mexico, India, and the UAE.
And the strategy behind these sanctions, what's the goal?
The goal, authorized under Executive Order 13581, which deals with transnational criminal organizations, is basically to cripple the HSO's entire financial network, disrupt their ability to operate. They're accused of smuggling thousands of people into the U.S., but also engaging in drug trafficking, bribery, money laundering. It really shows the administration using financial warfare, these powerful economic tools, as a primary weapon in its border security enforcement strategy.
Okay, lastly, on the economic front, let's touch on diplomacy. The president returned from that high-profile trip to Asia. The centerpiece was the meeting with President Xi Jinping in South Korea.
Right, in Gyeongju. President Trump hailed the meeting as a major success, rating it a 12 out of 10. The main outcome announced was a one-year trade truce.
A truce, not a resolution.
Exactly. More about stabilizing things, pausing hostilities, rather than solving the really deep disagreements on issues like intellectual property theft or human rights.
What were the specific tangible agreements that came out of it?
Okay, key points. China agreed to delay some planned export curbs they had threatened. And importantly for the U.S., they agreed to resume purchases of American soybeans. That's a big deal for U.S. farmers.
And what did the U.S. give?
The U.S. agreed to take threats off the table regarding hitting Chinese goods at American ports. And maybe controversially, the U.S. agreed to cut the tariff on fentanyl precursors in half.
Cutting the fentanyl tariff, that seems significant given the opioid crisis.
It is. It's seen as a major concession to China, a boom for their chemical exports, especially right before the holiday season. It definitely raises questions about the administration's strategy for using tariffs to combat the flow of fentanyl components.
Now, the most complex part of the talk seemed to be around technology, specifically advanced microchips, the key to AI dominance. What came out on that?
It's still pretty ambiguous, honestly. Trump confirmed they talked about chips. He said she confirmed he would talk to the company NVIDIA about buying chips. But, and this is crucial, Trump explicitly stated they were not talking about the really high-end stuff, the Blackwell chips, which are NVIDIA's most advanced AI processors.
So it highlights that unresolved tension.
Exactly. There's this deep debate raging in Washington. Should the U.S. sell any advanced chip technology to China? Mm. Could it actually help them build their own AI chip industry that eventually leapfrogs the U.S. got? U.S. experts are really divided on how much access compromises America's competitive edge in AI. That issue seems far from settled.
And the trip wasn't all hard-nosed trade talks, right?
Yeah.
There was some soft power diplomacy, too.
Yeah, a bit. They formalized the Republic of Korea, joining First Lady Melania Trump's initiative, Fostering the Future Together. It was done through a new technology prosperity deal focused on cooperation in AI and other emerging tech areas. So this relentless pace of executive action, defense, trade, regulation inevitably sparks major oversight questions and ethical debates, which leads us right into the friction points we saw developing inside the Justice Department and within Congress itself.
Let's start with what sounds like an absolute ethics minefield at the Justice Department. President Trump asking for a $230 million settlement from his own administration.
It's truly unprecedented. He's seeking this massive sum as compensation, claiming he was unfairly scrutinized during investigations related to the 2016 election and the classified documents cases. He's basically positioning himself as a victim of the very government he leads.
And the amount, $230 million, going directly into the president's pocket from taxpayer funds.
Mm.
Who actually has to decide whether to approve this claim?
That's where it gets incredibly complicated. The decision lands on the desks of the Deputy Attorney General, Todd Blanche, and the Associate Attorney General, Stanley Woodward.
Okay, and what's the problem there?
The problem is the massive conflict of interest. Both Blanche and Woodward previously served as President Trump's personal attorneys in private practice, and they both signed ethics agreements requiring them to recuse themselves from any matters directly involving the president for their first year in office.
Wait, so his former personal lawyers, who are supposed to be recused, are the only ones positioned to approve a potential $250 million payout from the government to their former client, who is now their boss.
That's the situation. It's what ethics experts are calling an egregious or dizzying conflict of interest. Richard Painter, who was the chief ethics lawyer under George W. Bush, flagged this immediately.
And he warned it could violate the Constitution. The Emoluments Clause.
Yes. The concern is about the Domestic Emoluments Clause. It's designed specifically to prevent the president from improperly profiting from his office. It prohibits the president from receiving any kind of payment or benefit emolument from the U.S. government itself beyond his official salary.
So, using taxpayer money, controlled by the executive branch he leads, to settle a personal claim. That looks like exactly what the clause forbids.
That's the argument. It seems like a clear case of the president potentially receiving personal enrichment directly from the government he controls, blurring the lines between public office and private financial gain in a way the founders wanted to prevent. Painter even suggested that if the payment were made, a future administration would likely sue Trump to try and get the money back.
Okay, besides that major ethics issue at DOJ, there were also serious alarms raised about the independence of a key watchdog nominee, the person tapped to be Inspector General at Health and Human Services, HHS.
Right. The nominee, Thomas Marchbell, created quite a stir because of a written pledge he made during his confirmation process.
What did he pledge?
He pledged to provide actionable information in support of the president's and secretary's courageous and innovative change of direction.
That sounds completely contrary to what an inspector general is supposed to do, right? Aren't they supposed to be independent and apolitical?
Absolutely. That's the core of the IG role. Oversight groups, former IGs, they all reacted with alarm. Mark Greenblatt, a former IG himself, basically said Bell's statement was a blinking neon sign saying, "I'm not fit for an IG position."
Because it's not their job to support a political agenda.
Exactly. Inspectors general are supposed to be neutral referees. They investigate waste, fraud, abuse, and mismanagement, and report the facts objectively, regardless of the political winds. They aren't supposed to be cheerleaders helping implement a specific administration's change of direction.
So the fear is he wouldn't be independent.
The fear is that Pledge suggests he might put a thumb on the scale, maybe shaping investigations or findings to favor certain policy outcomes promoted by the president or the HHS secretary. It undermines the very idea of independent oversight within the agency.
Okay, shifting gears to internal government operations. The Office of Personnel Management, OPM, announced this incredibly ambitious plan for HR modernization. It sounds almost technically impossible on the timeline they gave.
Yeah, OPM laid out this vision. Consolidate all 119 different federal HR systems handling everything from payroll to performance reviews for millions of employees into one single government-wide platform.
And the deadline they set.
July 4th, 2027. Highly symbolic, obviously. On the surface, it sounds logical, right? One modern system instead of 119 aging, disparate ones for 2 million employees. But people who actually understand federal IT systems are saying the feasibility, especially on that timeline, is basically zero.
Okay, let's break down why it's being called technical fiction or a hallucination, as one expert put it. What makes it seem impossible?
We can rely on commentary from Don Bauer here. He's a retired federal executive, spent decades deep in HR systems. He laid out three huge, probably insurmountable obstacles. First, just the sheer complexity of migrating the data. He calls it digital archaeology. Trying to pull 2 million personnel records out of 119 different systems, many using inconsistent or ancient data formats, and somehow clean it all up and load it into one new system without errors. It's a monumental task. Maybe impossible to do accurately.
And then there's the complexity of the rules themselves, right? Federal pay isn't simple.
That's maybe the biggest hurdle. The new system would have to perfectly reconcile dozens of different statutory pay systems. You've got Title V for general civil servants, Title 38 for VA medical staff, Title 10 for military civilians, and many others. Each has its own complex rules about who gets paid what, when, and why.
And getting all that logic right in one system has been tried before.
And failed, according to Bauer. He says the inherent inconsistencies between these different laws baked into the statutes themselves have defeated modernization efforts for decades. It's not just a tech problem, it's a legal and regulatory complexity problem.
Okay, third obstacle, getting it approved and running across the whole government.
The operational reality. Getting the security certification, the authority to operate, or ATO for a system used by 119 different agencies, all under the strict federal cloud security rules known as FedRAMP. Doing that within the planned 18-month deployment window, Bauer says that's virtually impossible from a bureaucratic and security standpoint. The July 4th deadline might be politically poetic, he says, but technically it's fantasy.
And this whole ambitious plan comes at a time when the workforce needed to do it is being hollowed out by the shutdown, the RAFs we talked about.
Precisely. That's the final nail in the coffin, arguably. The institutional knowledge needed to even attempt this kind of transformation. Bauer argues it's leaving the building. Years of hiring freezes, plus the recent RAF threats and potential layoffs, have gutted the experienced federal HR IT workforce.
So the very people who understand the Byzantine logic of those 119 old systems, the ones you'd need to stitch together something new.
They've retired, or they've left, or they're worried about losing their jobs. So even if you had more time, the expert talent required to pull off this kind of massive consolidation probably isn't even there anymore.
Okay, finally, let's bring it back to Congress itself. The legislative branch is still stuck, paralyzed on the main funding issue, even as it tries to carry out some of its other constitutional duties.
Right. The Senate was actually busy on October 30th with its advise and consent role. Four major committees held hearings, mostly focused on presidential nominations, including confirming the next commander of U.S. Strategic Command, a really critical national security post. So they are prioritizing those constitutional duties, even amid the appropriations chaos.
But the shutdown's practical effects are hitting even the senators now, right?
Yeah.
Physically impacting them.
Yeah, kind of ironic. Senators trying to leave D.C. for the weekend on Thursday, October 30th, found their flights delayed at Reagan National Airport, including Republican leaders like John Thune and Lisa Murkowski.
Why were the flights delayed?
FAA staffing shortages, directly linked to the shutdown. Air traffic controllers are working without pay, remember? Senator Murkowski was apparently so frustrated she voted no on the motion for the Senate to adjourn, protesting the business-as-usual attitude while the shutdown was causing these real-world problems. It shows the crisis is now tangibly affecting even the logistics of governing.
But the core political fight remains over how to end the shutdown. The immediate pressure point is that SNAP deadline tomorrow. But the bigger sticking point involves health care.
That seems to be the main political engine driving the paralysis here on day 30. On one side, you have the administration publicly calling for Senate Republicans to use the nuclear option, get rid of the filibuster entirely.
Which would let them pass funding bills with just a simple majority.
Exactly. Bypass the 60-vote threshold. It shows the administration's deep frustration with the traditional legislative process and minority rights in the Senate.
But the Senate Republican leadership, people like Thune, are still opposed to killing the filibuster, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even if some conservatives want targeted bills, like maybe just funding SNAP.
Right. Leadership seems reluctant to go that far, but the Democratic leverage point remains firm. They're saying they won't agree to pass a continuing resolution, a short-term funding bill to reopen the government, unless it also extends the Affordable Care Act, ACA subsidies.
Those subsidies are set to expire at the end of the year.
Correct. And if they lapse, the projections are stark. Older Americans who buy their own insurance but have incomes too high for Medicaid could see their monthly premiums spike dramatically. Estimates are as high as $920 more per month in 2026.
So that's the political standoff. SNAP funding versus ACA subsidies.
Hmm.
And the government stays shut while they argue.
That's the core stalemate driving the paralysis and causing harm. Meanwhile, adding to the pressure, Vice President J.D. Vance met with major airline CEOs and the transportation secretary at the White House on the 30th.
What came out of that meeting?
Reports indicate the airline CEOs delivered a stark warning. They said if air traffic controllers and TSA agents start missing paychecks due to the prolonged shutdown, it could lead to staffing shortages and potentially a disaster for air travel, especially heading into the busy holiday season. Just another ripple effect of the financial chaos.
Okay, that was an absolutely packed day. An exhaustive list of actions, regulations, crises, all crammed into the 24 hours starting October 30th, 2025. When you take a step back, synthesize everything the executive branch managed to push through. What are the big strategic themes you see emerging?
You know, looking at it all together, three major themes really jump out. They seem interconnected across almost every action we discussed. First, there's this maximalist assertion of executive authority.
Meaning what exactly?
Meaning, whether it's conducting those military strikes without clear congressional buy-in, or using mechanisms like immediate interim final rules like the EAD rule to make sweeping regulatory changes, the administration is consistently pushing the boundaries of presidential power, often bypassing the normal legislative process entirely, using the crisis as cover.
Okay, theme one, maximal executive power. What's second?
Second is the really strategic use of the national security framework to justify policies that seem fundamentally ideological, not necessarily security related in the traditional sense.
Give me examples of that.
Well, the EAD rule change, right? Justified by eliminating a supposed security vulnerability, even though the immediate predictable impact is massive economic disruption for legal workers and employers. Or the PSLF rule change for student loans, justified by protecting taxpayers from groups that might support terrorism, but functionally allows for ideological targeting of nonprofits based on their mission.
So using national security is a kind of all-purpose justification. What's the third theme?
Third, I'd say, is disruption as a policy tool. The administration seems willing to accept, and maybe even intentionally create, significant economic and social disruption if it serves their long-term goals.
Like weaponizing the USCIS delays to force legal workers out of jobs.
Exactly. Or using the threat of RAFs to permanently shrink the federal workforce. Or even just tolerating the data fog that's blinding the Fed. It seems disruption itself is seen as a valid, even preferred, tool for advancing specific ideological and political objectives.
So putting those three themes together, what does this all mean for you, the listener, trying to make sense of this? What's the practical takeaway from synthesizing all of October 30th?
I think the key finding, the big so what, is this. At day 30, the government shutdown isn't being treated by the executive branch primarily as a failure to be fixed. It's increasingly being viewed as an opportunity to be exploited.
An opportunity.
The reduced legislative oversight, the lower media saturation on specific policy details because everyone's focused on the shutdown drama. It provides the political space, the cover needed to enact policies that would normally face months, maybe years, of intense public debate and congressional scrutiny.
So what should stakeholders be doing right now? Businesses, nonprofits, policy analysts listening to this?
Well, immediate action is definitely needed on some fronts. Businesses absolutely need to conduct urgent reviews of their workforce compliance because of that EAD rule's immediate impact and the uncertainty it creates. Everyone should probably brace for continued market volatility. The Fed operating in this information vacuum means the risk of policy mistakes remains unusually high. And third, realistically, expect the inevitable legal challenges to those controversial DHS and Department of Education rules to become the main battleground. The fight will be in the courts, likely more than in Congress, at least initially.
That is a pretty stark conclusion. The sheer volume of really high consequence, often controversial executive actions packed into a single day is just remarkable. You're right, in normal times, any one of these, the DOD firing memo, the EAD termination, the PSLF changes, the nuclear testing directive would have dominated news cycles for weeks. But the crisis itself becomes the story, overshadowing the substance.
It does. And that leads to maybe the final provocative thought for you, the listener, to consider. In a world where the legislature seems increasingly marginalized by this kind of persistent partisan deadlock, where systemic crisis becomes almost normalized, are we starting to see the emergence of a new, maybe permanent model of governance, a model where the executive branch actively uses or even cultivates systemic crisis as its preferred method for making long-term transformative policy, effectively bypassing the traditional legislative process?
A powerful question to end on. Thank you for walking us through that truly unprecedented 24 hours of federal activity.
My pleasure. It was a lot to unpack.
I'm Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Kennedy.
And that's our deep dive for today.